aspecto legado tá? And because of this, the correlation functions follow exponentially. So at least we note that we have this situation and correlation functions follow exponentially. Whereas in the ferromagnetic phase, when there is a symmetry breaking, well, the situation is different because we have two degenerate down states that then are separated by some gap from the rest of the spectrum. But now what happens is that correlation functions of this type do not follow exponentially, but they have some finite value. So when I was not mic, I was saying that when you have a unique ground state and the gap, correlation functions fall off exponentially. But even if you have a gap, if the ground states degenerate, then they do not. So we would like to understand why is that. So this is a very important topic in condensed matter, that, and this kind of situation is exploited all the time, but we must understand why. So what we will see is that, first of all, this is a consequence of our system being a local quantum system. The second thing that I want to say is that there is some falling off of the exponential fall off of the correlation functions also in this situation, but we have to see for which observables. And the point here is that, so if you consider states like the symmetry broken states, like all spins up, and all spins down. So these states can be distinguished by a local operator. In particular, this operator sigma z at the site I reads out whether the spin is up or down. It can completely distinguish these two states. Or in other words, every local operator has some non-vanishing matrix elements between these two states. So because of this, when we compute correlation functions, in going from this state to this state, we don't really see the gap. So if we want to have this intuition that correlation functions decay exponentially because there is a gap between the ground state and the other states, so somehow when your observables for which you are computing correlation functions are connecting states for which there is no gap, this will fail. So in general, we, instead of saying that, okay, so in general we have this situation, that if the state, the ground state is not degenerate, non-degenerate ground state with a gap, delta, and therefore a correlation length psi, that is related in this way to the gap. Then the correlation functions, to be precise, the connected correlation functions, which are defined by, so this is the ground state, OA, OB. These are two observables that have support on some degrees of freedom A and some degrees of freedom B that are at the distance on our lattice system DAB. Okay, so the definition of correlation functions, the correlation function minus the background value in our ground state. So this is the definition. So if the state is non-degenerate and there is a gap, then the connected correlation functions, OA, OB, connected, fall off exponentially in this way. Okay? So when there is no degeneracy. Now let's see the situation in which we have our rest of the spectrum here, and then we have some low energy sector. So here we have a gap delta, and now here we have some small delta, that is the width of this band. So in particular, small delta it's zero in the case where the degenerate is safe. But what I mean here is that we have a general situation in which we have low-lying states, then a gap in the rest of the spectrum. And then I can consider the OA low and OA OB low, meaning is the projection of these observables onto this subspace. Okay? So in this case, the connected correlation functions have this behavior. We have a constant that goes like the commutator between OA low and OB low. Sorry, the anti-commutator. Some constant here, like 1 half. Plus an exponentially fall off term. So all the correlations are limited to those observables that have that connect states that are within the low energy sector where there is no gap. But everything else that is gapped has to fall off exponentially. Well, so when we actually, so it depends on what observable we choose. So for instance, for the SE model, when we choose some of these local observables, they always have some component, some non-trivial projection to the low energy. So an interesting question is, can we have both things at the same time? Meaning, can we have a degenerate ground state such that no matter what observable we choose, the correlation function and the gap, such that no matter what observable we choose, our correlation functions always decay exponentially? So this is one question that we will answer in a few lectures, but that I want you to keep in mind. So we would like to understand why this happens. So our goal is to show this behavior. And as I said, this is a consequence of the locality of the theory. So, which brings us to the topic of today, that is locality in quantum spin systems. In general, quantum spin system. So, and this starts with a very strange thing that we had. So, as you know, so far we've been dealing with non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So, I was writing Hamiltonians, and then we have our Schrödinger equation. There are no quantum fields. So there is no notion of a light cone in these theories. So this means that in principle, we could send the signals over an arbitrarily large distance in an arbitrarily small time. So usually when you use ordinary quantum mechanics in the non-many body context, you don't notice that. But now imagine that we have a spin chain, for instance. And I am in some state, some higher state of my theory, and then I apply suddenly perturbation on the first spin. Then you work out perturbation theory, and you will see that at some order in perturbation theory, for every t greater than zero, no matter how small, there is an influence of this perturbation at an arbitrarily large distance over here. So more or less, if this is the nth spin, this will happen at the nth order perturbation theory. So this is very, very bad, right? Because we know this is not possible. OK, so what? One solution is to say, oh, yeah, well, of course, you don't have a light cone. This is not the right theory. The right theory is quantum field theory. So this is just something nasty that happens because non-relativistic quantum mechanics is wrong. So today I want to show you, though, that the situation is, even in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, is not as bad as it seems, that in fact, without invoking a quantum field of relativistic invariance, as long as the way the evolution is induced has some notion of locality, we have an emergent light cone. So there is, so because it's like a condensed matter system, let me say there is a sort of speed of sound that is emerging from our system such that nothing can travel faster than that, at least approximately. So the emergent light cone, in fact, is fuzzy. So it's a fuzzy light cone, it's not sharp. And by fuzzy, what I mean is that if I take a point that is outside my light cone, here, and I have this distance of separation from the light cone, then all the causal violations are, so this distance, small l, are exponentially suppressed in this way. So the exponential fall off is very, very fast. From the experimental point of view, it means that we wouldn't be able to see violations of causality. So this means that even without having quantum field theory, we can see a light cone emerging, which works pretty well.
Like, what is the characteristic scale on which it decays when we go off the light cone?
Yeah. So you want to know the characteristic length?
Yeah.
We'll see that. So the short answer is that there is a characteristic speed and a characteristic length. The characteristic speed is the speed of the propagation interactions in the system that I was referring before. And the characteristic length is the lattice spacing. So at the end of the lecture, we'll see that when we send the lattice spacing to 0, this becomes short. Well, then, if you send the lattice spacing to 0, we obtain a quantum field theory. But we didn't impose, from the beginning, any relativistic invariance. It's just emerging. So the second reason why this topic is very important is that relativistic invariance doesn't tell you anything about how fast correlations can spread in the system. So as you, probably you have heard about the EPR paradox and entanglement of Bell inequalities. So you have learned that you cannot use this correlation to signal. So you can have very strong correlations that are superluminal, but correlations as such are not enough to produce a signal. So we could imagine, okay, fine, this means that in a condensed matter system, then we can have superluminal correlations because causality is not violated, so it's okay. But actually, also correlations have this locality behavior. So there is a fuzzy like Konotz of correlations. This means that if we start from some uncorrelated state in a quantum system, and we want to create correlations at a distance L, then we will have to evolve for a time that is L over V, where V is the speed of sound that is emerging in our system. Okay, so this is the motivation. Now, let's go to showing this. Okay, so first of all, what is a local quantum spin system? So we start with a graph. So we start with very simple some graph theoretic notions. So as you know, a graph is a pair. It's a set, lambda, and then which is called the set of vertices. And another set, E, that is called the set of edges. And what is E is just a subset of the power set of lambda. So this means that if I have some set lambda, so a subset of the power set is something that contains this set, this set, this set, maybe this set. So this is a subset of the power set, and these subsets that are elements in the power set are, for instance, at the edges of my graph. So in particular, if I want to draw it, I have to put a link here, a link here, a link here. Well, and here there is a hyperlink. So let me put a loop and shade it. Because instead of it being just an edge between two nodes, there are three nodes that have to be considered all together. Okay. So to every vertex in lambda, we want to associate a local hyperspace. That we will call H sub, HX. And, okay, so first requirement, the dimension of this local hyperspace is finite. Second requirement, the Hilbert space of our theory, so H lambda, is just the tensor product of local Hilbert spaces. So with these two requirements, we will call our system a generalized spin system. Namely, because our degrees of freedom are some, so if this dimension, let me call it, are D-level systems. graph theoretic notions that we need is that even if we do not embed the graph in real space, so even if we do not define a matrix, there is always a graph theoretic metric that is naturally already associated to our graph that is called graph distance. And the graph distance is obtained by counting along some path how many steps there are from one node to another, and then minimizing over all the possible paths. Okay? So let me draw a graph that is a square lattice. So the distance between this node and this node is the minimum distance that can be, so the minimum number of steps for, that I can use to connect them, so it's 1, 2, 3, 4. And actually, on a square lattice, this is the same if I do this path or this path. It's always 4. It's called Manhattan distance. Okay. Now we want to define a local Hamiltonian. So to define a local Hamiltonian, we will define what we call an interaction map. So an interaction map is a map that takes a subset of my vertices and interaction map phi gives me a bounded operator over h x. So because x is a subset of the lattice by h x, large x, capital X, I mean the tensor product of all my local, ultra-local integer spaces.
So is this x large or small?
So it's a, this is capital X. And this is calligraphic X. So just like here I was tensoring over all the possible vertices in lambda, and now I'm tensoring over only just some subset. So we will call an interaction map R local if the maximum diameter of my of the subsets X that I choose is smaller than this number R. So, and then, again, like I said last time, if I take a subset of points in my graph, the diameter is simply the maximum graph distance between any two points that belong to the set. So, in order to define this notion, we don't even need the subset X to be connected. Yep.
What is B?
E?
Well, B on the right.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. So this is the bounded linear operators on this Hilbert space. So I could even have said just the linear operators in Hilbert space because these are finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. So these operators are automatically found. And actually, we want these operators to be also admission. Okay? Well, then we define our Hamiltonian, like the sum over our X in the lattice, capital S, of these interaction terms. So this is a very general setting. So with this Hamiltonian, we will say that we have a local quantum spin system. So it's a spin system that is defined by these conditions on the Hilbert space, endowed with the Hamiltonian that is the sum of the local operators in this sense, local in that sense. So, example. In the quantumizing model, we have a graph that can be a chain or a square lattice, whatever you want. And then what is our interaction map? So we have terms of the type x1. So by x1, I mean the diameter of x1 is 0. And then, so, and these terms are just g, jg, sigma z. So if the diameter is 0, this means that this subset consists of some, just some vertex, one vertex, that we were labeling with I, and so it's I. And then we have phi x2 means the diameter is of x2 is 1. So the diameter of xr in general is r minus 1. So this number is telling you how many bodies you have in this term. So the diameter is this number minus 1. And this was sigma x I sigma x j when ij is what I call x2. It's an edge in my graph. And then on all the other possible subsets, my interaction map gives me nothing, gives me 0. Well, then the sum of all these terms, plus the sum of all these terms, gives me the icing. Yeah.
Is there a reason why we choose z or x, or is that a choice?
Oh, no, no, of course. I mean, with the rotation, I know that I usually define the icing model in this way.
Okay.
But it should be fairly clear that it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
Right. So, what matters is that this term and this term are anti-commute. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, it's the same model up to some unitary transformation.
Question.
Yeah.
So what's the notation for the link? Is it x tau or?
Oh, no, sorry, this is x2.
Oh.
So x2 so means that is an edge that contains two points, and in the icing model, I was calling it ij.
Okay. Any
question? Sorry?
A question here. You say that the XR, the diameter, will be R minus 1, but I don't see how, because you can have X2 interactions that are not at two nearest neighbors. So.
Yeah, so this is in the icing mode. This is an example.
Okay, but yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I'm just choosing the notation for this example. Okay. So now we want to show what happens when we have, so imagine this is my system, and I have some subset A on which I define some operator A hat. Then I have some other system, subsystem B. So imagine I have a lattice, you know, a big graph or a lattice, and this is just a subset of the spins in my lattice. And they are separated by graph distance d, these two lumps. Also here I have defined an operator v hat. Well, we immediately see that these two operators commute. So this is to generalize spin systems. If two operators do not have, if their support does not overlap, so by the way, so the formal definition of what is a support is the following. So imagine that because if I have an operator on my Hilbert space, so this is defined, so if this belongs to the bounded operator for my total Hilbert space, then this is defined on somehow on the whole tensor product. So now imagine that this operator has the following form. It is T, some operator TA that is acting on, that is defined on HA, tensor the identity in the rest of the lattice. Then I would say that the support of O is HA. Okay, so this is the formal definition.
Okay.
So this, in a spin system, operators that have supports that do not overlap will commute. So for this reason, these are also called local bosonic models, as opposed to if instead we have some Feldman system, operators that are at distance would not commute, in fact, they anti-commute.
Excuse me, what stands after TA? TA?
TA tensor?
Yes, the tensor then.
What's the question?
What stands after tensor sign?
This?
Yeah.
This is the identity?
Ah, it's identity. Oh, okay.
On the whole lattice, but on A.
Do you mean the correlation function of A and T should be zero?
So, no, right now what I'm saying is that these two operators commute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But correlation function is something that you evaluate in a state. Right? It's some expectation value. This is not an expectation value. This is something that happens to the operators. I'm not taking the expectation value right now with these operators.
Mm-hmm. But A multiply B equal to the normal order of A, B, and the commutator of A, B.
That's correct, but the correlation function is not is A, B evaluated in some state, some expectation value.
Okay.
I'm not evaluating this in any state. This is an operator. So this is an output, right? Now we want to see what happens when we evolve our operator A in time. So because we have Hamiltonian, we will have associated a time evolution to operators, and of course they evolve in the Heisenberg picture. So this will be e to the iht A e to the minus iht. Well, and now you see that immediately, for every t greater than zero, so if you develop this exponential, so even if h is the sum of local terms, when you develop this exponential, you will have all the powers of h, which means that for every t greater than zero, the support of A of T is the whole Hilbert space. Right? Because we will have terms, because in here there are terms with support on the whole Hilbert space. So this whole operator will have support on the whole Hilbert space. Well, this means that then, for every t greater than zero, no matter how small, these two operators will not commute anymore. So this is an operatorial instance of what I was saying before, that in a non-relativistic quantum mechanics, things that happen here have some influence to things that happen here, as I simplified from the fact that these commutators are different from zero. So it seems that we are in a very bad shape. However, and so this is what we want to show is how much we apply the rate. So how much, and we take the whole scale, so we can do two things. We can try to evaluate this quantity in some state, and maybe do the statistics of what these objects look like in different states. Or we can do something more drastic. We can do the worst case scenario. We can take the norm of this operator. So as you know, the norm is just the soup of so the norm of an operator A is just the norm of xi, so it's the norm of state after I take the soup over all the possible signs. So this is the worst case scenario because this gives me the maximum amount that this is an upper bound to the values of the expectation value of this operator. So if this is small, then maybe things are not so bad. So we would like to show that this object is small if A and B are far apart with respect to the evolution time t. So if there is a v such that v times t is much smaller than v, then this object should be very small. So this is what we want to prove. So in particular, we would like to prove that there is a v that somehow emerges in this system, such that this quantity is upper bounded by some constant, and then we have e to the minus vt minus d over some length. And it's the other way around. D minus. Minus d plus vt. So this means that when d is larger than vt, this object is exponentially suppressed. So if our, you know, if our xi is small enough, this would mean that even a very tiny violation, meaning we just move a little bit away from the light cone, we already are not able to see anything anymore, because exponential fall off is very, very quick. Okay, so this is what we want to prove. So this is the first thing that we want to prove, and it's called Lieb-Robinson bound, which is the essential ingredient then to prove our statements on the correlation functions that we found up there. But this is the essential tool. It has a huge use in condensed matter theory, modern condensed matter theory. So although this Lieb-Robinson bound was found 35 years ago, it's only the last 5 years or so that has been rediscovered, basically, and used ubiquitously as a tool to understand condensed matter systems. Okay, so let's prove. So let me call this commutator, of which we want to make the bound, let me call it f of t. It's just a function of t. And let me take the time derivative of f. Well, as you know, I can do the time derivative by commuting with the Hamiltonian. Right? This is the Schrödinger equation, basically. And so I can write A of t, H I'm only commuting this part with the Hamiltonian because this doesn't depend on time. So if you, it's in it. Okay. Well, now because h is also equal to h of t, because the Hamiltonian commutes with the its exponential, with the unitary operator associated to it. Well, then I can write, because of this, then I can write minus I u t a h u dagger t commutator b, where of course u t is this. It's the unitary associated to my Hamiltonian. Okay. And now let's insert our fact that our Hamiltonian is the sum of local operators. So it has that shape over there. Well, then this becomes minus I sum over order x of a of t phi x of t commutator b. Well, what I did was then to put back the unitaries inside the commutator. So this is what I did now. Oh, actually, I don't want to do it yet. So let me u t, u love it. I'll do that in a second. Okay, so you notice something that if x, so of course, I was using the symbol hat A for the operator and just A for the support of this operator. Of course, when I use A in this equation, it's of course the operator, right? So I will forget to put the hat a certain number of times. But when I'm talking about sets, it's the support. So there should be no ambiguity. So but if X and A have a null intersection, well then, as we saw, phi x and a operator must commute. Right? So if they commute, it means that when they have null intersection, everything here goes to zero, because this goes to zero and then commuted with b. So this means that I can restrict my sum over here to those terms that have a non-null intersection. Sorry, here, I was saying null intersection. So when they have null intersection, they must commute. So I will have to restrict my sum to those terms that have a non-null intersection. So let me call the set Z1 is the set of x in lambda such that x intersected A is different from the empty set. Then I can, okay, so let me write another passage, limit my sum to the sets x1 that belong to z1, and now just so the notation that I'm using here has nothing to do with the number, with the diameter of our set. It's just an index to remind me where these terms live. So they live in this set that I call the Z1.
Can I have a question?
Yeah.
This set Z1 is all the sets that are can be in, done within the A set, or
these are all, so we have all these subsets of lambda that are called X, on which we have defined our interaction map. Okay. Now, some of these will have a non-null intersection with A. So for instance, imagine it's the IC model. Then we have these things that are operating on nearest neighbors, basically. So this object that operates between these two spins has null intersection with A. But all these will have a finite intersection with A, and those that are that live inside A as well, and then that's it. So there are not many, right? So we are restricting our sum to this, and then I put back my unitaries. So I will have A of T, now phi x1, because the support of these x1s, of T, and this commutator is commuted with B. Okay, now I will do a trick. I will use the Jacobi identity. For the commutators. So I will write this commutator. So let me write it here. So can you see over here?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Jacobi identity, I will write it as the sum of two commutators. So let me just write it, minus I, sum over x1, then I have A of T commuting with phi x1 of t comma b plus a of t commuting b and then phi x1. Okay? There could be some sign error, but you will see in a second that it doesn't matter anything because I will take the norms. So the signs will go away. Okay, so what we see now, this is an important step, is that this object here is A of T commutator B. It's my initial, it is my initial object, it's my initial function F of T.
Which function is
this? Is this.
But
it's
up
here. A, B. So this thing is a linear differential equation for this operator. Right? Because this is some linear operator, because I'm just commuting with some operator and taking the sum of all these things. So I can call this L0 of T times f of t. Well, and all this is some other linear operator g of t. So we have our differential equation is f prime of t is equal to g of t plus l0 t f t. Okay, so how we solve this linear differential equation? We first find the solution to the homogeneous differential equation when g is 0. So just this, but now you see, I want you to notice this, that if you only have this term, you are evolving, you are commuting this object with the sum of these admission operators. So you are the generator of my evolution is some admission operator, which means that the solution will be some unitary operator. So whatever is the solution gamma t to the homogeneous equation, so that gamma t takes my f of 0, it gives me my f of t equal gamma t f of 0. This is a unitary operator. This is nothing fancy. This is just this object has the form f of t comma some Hamiltonian h prime. So my homogeneous equation is this. It's just the Schrödinger equation. So why I care that this unitary? Because a unitary operator, because it's unitary, is a norm of preserving. So this means that the norm of f of 0 is equal to the norm of f of t. I will use this thing in a second. Okay, so this is the solution. So gamma of t is the solution to the homogeneous equation. So the solution to the inhomogeneous equation will be this. So f of t will be equal to gamma t f of 0 plus I integrate between 0 and t, and I take my gs, I pull it back with gamma s minus 1, and I integrate in ds, and then I roll back with gamma. Okay, so this is a just non-factoring calculus. Okay, but now we want to take the norm of f of t. Because remember that we are interested in finding some bound to the norm of this object, that is f of t. So by applying the triangular inequality, I will have that is smaller than the norm of this plus the norm of this. But this is norm preserving, which is what I just showed. So this is the norm of f of 0 plus 0 t. Yeah, all the gammas, I can ignore them when I take the norm, because they're non-preserving. Well, and then I produce another bound, or where it's the triangular inequality, if I put the norm inside the integral. So I have the gs ds. So, and now I would like to see what is the norm of this GS. So it's the norm of this object, right? So the norm of this object is, okay, so what do I have here? I have the commutator, let me look at the outer commutator. So if I have a, b, this is smaller than 2ab, so small a, right? So here I will take 2, the normal value of t, but the normal value of t is just the norm of a, because again, a of t, by definition, is just the one that has been evolved with a unitary evolution, so the norm is not changing. So this is 2a. Then I have the sum over all the x1s, and I'm taking the norm inside the sum. So every time, I can always do that and making a further upper bound. And then I have the norm, some point here, this is right. And then I have the norm of phi x1 of t, commutator b. Okay, and then I'm integrating this over s. Okay, so we need somehow to evaluate this curve. Is the commutator of some, the time evolution of phi x1 commutator b. But this is a similar problem to this one, right? I mean, phi x1 is some other Hermitian operator that has simply different support from a. So I can apply the same method again. And if I apply the same method again, I will see that, okay, let's see if I find something. Some space, okay. So let's see. The norm of phi x1 of s b. So now I want to do the same trick. Okay, so let's run. Let's do it explicitly So let me take the time derivative. Let me take away the norm for now. Let me take the time derivative of this. So again, this is okay, minus I. So you realize that if I forget from now on, the minus I doesn't matter, because then I will take the norm and they will disappear. So now I have the sum over again all the x's. And here I have the commutator fx1 fx b. Right? So now we have the similar situation than before. This is different from 0 only if these x's have a non-null overlap with x1. So we call them x2, where obviously z2 is the set of x2 in lambda such that x2 intersect x1 is non-null when x1 is in z1. So I have a recursive definition of what I mean by zn, right? Because zn is defined in terms of zn minus 1, meaning all those sets that have non-null supports with the elements of zn minus 1, non-null intersection with the elements of zn minus 1. So this means that now this sum can be restricted to the x2, and I can put my s here back, because I can always make this trick of pulling the limiters up and up. Then I do the my Jacobi identity again. So I will find, so my sum over x2 will contain the commutator of fx1b, okay, ns, commutator fx2, plus the commutator between fx1 and b, function of s, fx2. Okay. Good. Oh, but this is my function, the function that I'm differentiating. So I can again do the same thing.
Excuse me, there is one, it's the same term. These two terms are the same term.
These two terms. No, this is phi x1 commutator b commuting f phi x2, and this is phi x1, and you're right. Okay. Very good, thanks. So the one that is the initial term is this one. Okay, so this means that when I take the norm of my phi x1, with B, what will happen here is that I will have, so this is smaller than, okay, so the first part is that I have two phi x1 then plus 0 s and then again phi x1 times phi x2. I should do all the calculation.
What did you get the first term?
So this is, so the first term is, okay, so the we have the solution of the phi x1 commutator b. So we have this term that comes from the solution of the homogeneous equation.
It's evaluated at zero. This one is evaluated at zero and the other one is evaluated at x.
Yes, so this is the one evaluated at zero. Because, I mean, the s part gets lost in the norm. But let me write this in the next
question. We should put some arguments in other ways than just the same left and right side.
Yeah, no, of course, you could just change the names, but I just want to write it correctly. So, plus 2 phi x1 0 s sum over x2, okay, and then I have phi x2 over s b. And this is in the s. Okay. And of course, this is just 2 b phi x1. So if I plug it inside my expression here, what I find is that f of t is smaller than f of 0, but f of 0 is 2ab, because it's just a commutator between a and b. Then I have plus 2a, the integral between 0 and t, sum over x1, 2b, phi x1, and then we have plus, so this is there is a parenthesis here, 2 phi x2, no, 2 phi x1 again, 0 s, sum over x2, and now we have this last commutator, phi x2 b. So now what I want to do is that I want to iterate. I can do this thing n times. If I do it n times, you will see I find that this is, so that f of t is smaller than, so I always get 2ab, every order. Then I have 1 plus the integral between 0 and t of sigma x1 phi x1 plus the integral between 0 and t and 0 s1 of sigma x2. Now I have the product phi x1 phi x2, and then in general, so the n term will be 0 s n minus 1, so this is the integral, all the nested integrals from 0 t to 0 s n minus 1, and then the sum over all x1 up to xn, and the product of, so let me write like this, product between 1 and n of the norm of phi xi. So this is what you find. Now we do a trick for the nested integrals. So you know that the nested integral 0 t 0 s1, 0 sn minus 1 in dt, s1, dsn minus 1, this is equal to 1 over n factorial, the integral between 0 and t, n times. So this is a trick that, for instance, you use when you evaluate the Dyson series. Okay, so if I do this, I can write, the other thing that we do is that, So we know that these operators, all these operators are bounded operators, right? They belong to the set up there. Phi x belongs to the bounded operators of my Hilbert space. So this means that for every phi x, there is a number. So there is a number k such that it's bigger than phi x for every x. So this means that my generic term in this series can be written like 1 over n factorial. Then I have my integral 0t, 0t n times. Then I have this number k to the n. And then I have this sum over x1, xn. But now this is not summing over anything. So this means that this is just a pure number. So this is the number of all the ways I can connect A with B by using the patches on my lattice that are made of the supports of my interaction map, patches that have always some overlap between each other. And this is all the possible ways of connecting them. So it's the number of all these possible interacting paths on my lattice. So it's a number that I would want to evaluate. Let me call it just large sigma. So this is a graph. It's a combinatorial number. It's the number of paths. Well, then I can produce, and also I think there was also a 2 here, because every time I take a commutator, there is a 2. So there is also a term that goes like 2 to the n. So this means that our generic element of this series has the form 2 to the n. Then I can do an upper bound again, because these are just constants. This is just t to the n, t is greater than 0. Then I have k to the n over n factorial. And then I have these numbers s. So this is the generic element of my series. So my the norm of f of t is smaller than 2ab times the sum for every n from 0 to infinity. Okay. So this is the first result. Yeah?
So the sigma, doesn't that depend on n?
That's very right. But sigma. So now we need to evaluate this sigma. So you see that we see that there is an exponential that is trying to leap. So we need to find a smart way to write this object like an exponential. So again, what is this number? This is the number of paths that are connecting A with B. So what is this number of paths? So first of all, there are, imagine that these patches that I'm overlapping have a maximum volume that I call small sigma. Okay. So the number of ways that this one can overlap with a nearby one is most sigma different ways. So the number of paths of length n, the total number of paths of length n, will be something that is like sigma to the n. So now we are overcounting a little bit, right? Because we want all the paths of length n that connect A with B. So in order to get a little better counting, I can multiply this object with this exponential, nr minus t. So, because our patches have a diameter that is at most r, in n steps I can cover a distance that is at most n r. Now you see that when n r is greater than d, this is a positive exponential. So by multiplying by this function, I am actually producing a bound. When nr is smaller than d, this is a quantity greater than 0, although smaller than 1. But when nr is smaller than d, there are no paths that connect a and b. So this is OK, still an upper bound. So I can produce another upper bound by putting this function here, sigma n e to the lambda and r minus d. OK, so we are ready to wrap up. What is this? This is 2ab. And now this is just one exponential. It is the exponential of 2tk sigma e to the lambda r over lambda minus d, and I put a lambda in front here. And now let me define d, this quantity, 2k sigma e to the lambda r over lambda. And actually, because lambda, so the lambda that I chose here is, so this is true for every lambda greater than 0. So in order to make the bound tight, I can just minimize this quantity over lambda. Typically, for typical graphs, lambda is a quantity that's like 2.1, this type of stuff. And so we end up with the e to the lambda dt minus d. And this is the promise theorem. So you see that the norm of the commutator, when t is greater than dt, falls off exponentially outside the light cone, which is the promised result. And then one last comment. We are using these v and d are measured in graph theoretic distances. Mm-hmm. Right? We are just counting the number of steps. Now imagine that we embed our graph in some matrix space so that we can say that our lattice distance is some quantity a. So this just becomes lambda over a. So you see that when a is very, very small, this becomes sharper and sharper and sharper. And that in the limit of a going to 0, there is no possible influence as measured by the norm of the commutator outside of the light cone.
Could you just again say what small sigma was?
So small sigma is the maximum volume of these patches. The patches are the axis, the support of our operators. So they have different volumes, but the maximum volume, so sigma is the max over all the possible axes of the volume of x that graph theoretically is called. The cardinality of x. So if you we don't have relativistic quantum mechanics, we have an emergent light cone. Yeah.
Do we assume that 1k works for all the phi x?
This one?
Yeah.
So they are all bounded operators, and that is just the biggest of all the bounds.
And there are a finite number of them.
There are actually a finite number of them because we are on a finite lattice. But so even if they were infinite, there would be a soup. So that would be the soup. that is not a problem.
Just to be sure, small a at the end, does it appear by renaming lambda?
No. It appears by expressing the distances that appear here.
Oh.
So D becomes D over A, and the space in V is X over A. And so, and then it will have to be A. So this is what happens when I embed my graph in a metric space.